Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Detroit and earned a law degree from Wayne State Law School. In 1973, with Randy Agley, he co-founded Telon LLC, an investment firm focused on manufacturing and real estate companies. He and his family have developed and funded many self-help projects in Uganda, and he is the chairman of Prison Fellowship International. His name? Mike Timmis, and we're honored to have him as our guest. I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now, back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to Mike Timmis, the chairman of Prison Fellowship International. Mike, it's an honor to have you.
Jack, it's great to be here and great to be with you always.
Welcome back from China.
Thank you.
Can you talk about your childhood and your parents?
Well, I had a great childhood. I grew up on the west side of Detroit. Detroit then was kind of divided into ethnic enclaves, and I grew up in a predominantly Irish neighborhood, and it was, homes with 40-foot lots, and if you did something wrong, your mother would hear about it before you got home from the playground. People looked out for themselves. We didn't have any key to our house. I had wonderful parents, and they gave me values that to this day are the most important values in the world, and that was God, education, and work.
And you get a law degree, you start practicing law, and you meet a man, Randy Agley.
Okay. Before that, Jack, the most important meeting I ever had is I met my wife, Nancy, at Wayne State University. We were both juniors. I fell in love with her by sight. I fell in love with her before I knew her name, and we were married right after we graduated and before I went to law school. Nancy taught the 3 years I was in law school, high school English, and God has blessed me in over 43 years of marriage to the most wonderful woman that I've ever met. I met Randy Agley in the middle 60s. He had just graduated from University of Michigan's business school and worked for Arthur Andersen in the audit department, and we were thrown together on a number of mutual clients between Arthur Andersen and the law firm I was then working with. We kind of hit it off, and one day we were flying home from Houston, and we had just negotiated a huge amount for a man who wanted to sell his business, and we got almost 10 times what he was asking for it. And we said, you know, if only we could do that for ourselves. Unfortunately, we didn't have any money. However, Randy had developed a relationship with three men who were then the largest McDonald's franchisees in the country, and they were so successful and making so much money. In the early days, the franchisees had tremendous returns that they made enough money they were going to go onto the New York Stock Exchange and be listed. And McDonald's would have none of that, so they bought them out at an exorbitant price. And they were interested in backing some young guys, namely Randy and then me, in business. And that really was the foundation of Telon.
What has Telon focused on for these 33 years?
Well, we've tried to focus on being profitable and having integrity and character and being fair to our employees, and that's just not self-serving. I could give you many examples. you know, in a lifetime of business of over 30 years, you have winners and losers. We've made mistakes, and but at the end of the day, I believe that when you look at our careers, we have been builders. We have created a lot of jobs. We have helped a lot of people, and now we're at the point in life where we still have our, some of our businesses, but we also have the time to contribute to the community and well as other endeavors.
In today's world, more and more people, couples, are thinking about becoming entrepreneurial, going out on their own. You've been around entrepreneurs your whole life. What is it about them that makes them successful?
Well, I'm not even sure what the true definition of an entrepreneur is. I know one when I see it, but people have asked me that many, many times. I think that people who are willing to take a risk, willing to work very hard, and in some ways be a self-sacrificer for a dream. And I think that it takes a certain amount of intelligence, a certain amount of backing, but most of all, it takes a lot of drive.
Are there still opportunities out there?
There will always be opportunities. This is the most mobily upward country in the entire world. And entrepreneurs are being born and prospering every single day. Anyone who thinks those days are over or in the past, they're just wrong.
You've been to 111 countries visiting various prisons, etc. So you meet people from all over the world. You're seeing capitalism, entrepreneurship flourish in many countries that never had that opportunity before.
Absolutely. Let me just give you a little example. In Uganda, which is the African country that I have visited the most because our son lived there for 7 years, cell phones came in. The country would never be hardwired in telephones. It just cannot support that infrastructure. But then cell phones came in from South Africa, and it was amazing overnight how that impacted the country. I'm driving down a road. A man has built a rickety 30-foot platform, and he's sitting up there with a cell phone, and he charges people coming down the road a certain amount to use this cell phone. Now, there is a true entrepreneur, saw an opportunity, took advantage of it, and is following his dream and making money in a country where it is very difficult to make money.
We're talking to Mike Timmis, who at age 40 had everything except peace and happiness. When we come back, we'll talk about what changed. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Mike Timmis, the co-founder of Telon LLC. Mike, you're 40 years old. You have it all. What was missing?
Well, as I look back, Jack, I realize I was living a very self-centered life. I thought I was working hard, creating security, doing the right things for my family. But in truth, as I look back, it was sort of a self-centered pursuit for power, glory, I guess. Although, in all honesty, at the time, I didn't recognize that. But the more I got to know myself through God's eyes, the more I realized that what I thought I was doing for my family, I was really doing for myself. And so consequently, when you're a perfectionist and you demand perfection from everyone around you, it's very difficult for them. And it becomes very lonely for them if they can't meet your expectations. And either consciously or subconsciously, I was conveying that to my son. And certainly my wife and I were growing quieter and quieter in our marriage. And in some ways, I was either excessively kind or excessively demanding.
And what changed?
Well, I mean, we tried to do certain things. I would take her away, and I wouldn't call back to the office and what have you, but they were Band-Aids. But one night she asked me to go to a dinner, and I said, well, we had kind of made a deal that we wouldn't go out socially unless to a party or something like that, unless we're going to invite people back within 6 months to our own home, and that cut a lot of our social calendar out. So when I asked her who was giving the dinner and she said she didn't know, I was quite surprised. And I said, well, is it a charity dinner or a political dinner or what is it? And she says, what's the dinner on religion? And I said, well, I'm a Roman Catholic. I'm not interested in going to hear any dinner on religion and being with a bunch of holy rollers. And from that moment of saying no to walking into the door of this club where this dinner was held, I have no recollection. And I honestly have no recollection. I walked in, and there was a guy at the door who was a good friend of mine, and he said, Mike, what the heck are you doing here? Only he used different words. And I said, like you, I'm dragged here with my wife. He says, why don't you go down and have a drink with me in the bar? I said, I better not. So I sat down at this dinner, and I wasn't pleased to be there, and I could see a lot of guys like myself who weren't pleased to be there. And a lawyer sat down next to me, and he had done something that he shouldn't have done, and he was trying to gauge my anger because I had a notorious temper at that time. And so I didn't pay any attention to my wife or to the guy on my left, but I did pay attention to the speakers. And there was one speaker, a guy from Grosse Pointe, an accountant with Ford Motor Company, who got up, and this is all he said. He said, look it. I don't know why they asked me to speak here tonight. He says, I don't have any story. I never had any crisis in my life or anything like that. He says, all I can tell you is I'm a sailor. And one night, a Friday night at 9 o'clock at night, I was working on my sailing gear. And I knelt down by my bench and said, Jesus, if you're real, come into my life and change me. He did. He's in my life, and life has never been the same. And he was a humble guy, and I looked at his face, and I knew he was telling the truth. And I was stunned because I had never heard anybody use the name Jesus except in a swear word in public. And at the end of the evening, I was invited to say a little prayer, inviting Jesus into my life and to help him to change me. Now, for me, this was not a matter of faith because being a Roman Catholic, I always believed that Jesus Christ was who he said he was. But I realized that I never thought of him as a personal friend, as someone that was with me constantly, as someone who loved me with such a passion that I could not begin to understand. So I said the prayer, and quite frankly, there were no bells or whistles going off, and I went home. My wife and I never talked about the evening. About 10 days later, I got a call from a guy, and he said, Mike, he gave me his name. I didn't know him, although he said he went to my church. He said, would you like to join a Bible study? I said, no. And his voice cracked. And he said, wouldn't you come just once? And I said, no. And he said, just once? And I said, what happened? Did you get the short straw and have to call me? And he was obviously very embarrassed or shy, whatever. I said, okay, I'll come once. And I can remember going to meet. There was a group that met every Thursday at noon in the Renaissance Club for soup and bread and soup. And I can remember driving down there and thinking, fighting with myself all the way. This is not for you. Why would you go and do this? And so I walked in the room, and uncharacteristically for me, I never said a word. And anybody that knows me well says, you know, that's probably a miracle. But in any event, I just saw a group of business and professional people, and they were struggling like I was to be better husbands, better fathers, and trying to find how they could do that, sharing their stories. There was no talk about religion or denomination. I never even knew the denominations, I don't to this day, of the men sitting around the table. but they were genuinely seeking to become better men, and that appealed to me greatly. And what appealed to me the most was starting to read God's love letter, which we call the Bible, which is, you know, his scripture written over 1,500 years in the Hebrew scripture, the Old Testament, and the New Testament. And then I began to see myself as I read those words, sort of like in a mirror, in the way God sees me. And that really profoundly changed my life.
How did it change your family's life?
Well, it certainly impacted our marriage right in the beginning. And I realized that I had to make a lot of amends. I had to control my temper. I had to change the way I speak. I became, unfortunately, I thought I had the cure for eternal cancer, and I was going to give it to my kids. And I was very immature, and of course, I was a workaholic, and now I became a Christaholic, which was not good.
When we come back, we'll talk further to Mike Timmis, who just got back from China, where he chaired a conference with representatives from 115 countries. I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Crisula.
We're talking to Mike Timmis. Mike, you go to this dinner, you have a couple follow-up meetings. What came next?
Well, I started meeting every week with a man who helped me learn scripture, and I joined this group. And that was the next 2 years was probably the happiest time of my entire life. And I, in turn, started a group, and we started meeting with some of my close friends and doing exactly the same thing. And so my marriage had changed dramatically. My relationship with my kids was really improving. Then on November 7th, 1985, our 15-year-old daughter died tragically. And it was, I can't tell you, an indescribable blow. I love my daughter with every fiber of my being. It was the one thing I felt that I had done the best with in my relationship with her. But during that time of her immediate death and the time after, we all felt the strong presence of God in our life. As a matter of fact, I've said that if I hadn't embraced God in the way that I did, I probably would have taken my life. I just couldn't imagine life without our daughter. But during that time, I learned that even through the suffering, God is always with you, and that as he promises us that he will never leave us or forsake us, and he will help us get through it. And that's exactly what he did. And he did that by giving us a sense of tremendous compassion for others.
They say that the toughest thing for a husband and wife to endure is the loss of a child. A lot of families have that awful experience each day. What advice would you give those families?
Well, I know that about two-thirds of marriages break up after the loss of a child. And I can tell you that by praying together, loving, not reading self-help books. In my case, I prayed and retreated in the scripture. My wife went to a grief counselor, which helped her tremendously. But we stayed together, and we really concentrated on being together, not apart.
When we come back, we'll talk to Mike Timmis about how he got involved with Prison Fellowship International. I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Crisula.
Welcome back. We're with Mike Timmis. Mike, how did you learn of and get involved with Prison Fellowship International.
Well, that's a story, Jack, that goes almost back to my childhood, because in our family, we always thought about the poor, so I would say that family influence. And then I met a man when I graduated from law school named Gene Dreiker, one of the most prominent lawyers in the state. And he had grown up much like me, and he said, you know, Mike, now that you're out practicing law, is the time of it's your time to start giving back, because others have given for you so that you would, from your background, could be a lawyer, and now start thinking about that. And I did. I was made a partner in my law firm in 5 years, and at that time Nancy and I decided to become friends with someone in the inner city, and there we found a widow with 5 kids, and we started becoming friends and starting to help her. So it was I was always conscious of the fact that there were not only poor people, but I had a responsibility to help them to the best of my ability. But as I got older and busier, that would be sort of sending a check. The middle 80s, I started thinking about taking some of the wealth that I had accumulated and setting up a foundation and started helping the poor. And I did that. And we started doing projects in Peru and Honduras and ultimately Nicaragua. And in 1988, our son graduated from Marquette University and decided to go to Africa for a year to help the poor. And needless to say, that was a very difficult thing for me to accept. Uganda had gone through a period of off and on civil war for 17 years. There was no infrastructure. Having lost one child, to lose our only remaining child was a tremendous fear. However, God did give us the peace that passes all understanding, and 3 months after he graduated from college, he left for Uganda. And we thought he would stay a year. He ended up staying 7. He was going to go to law school, had been accepted to a number of law schools. We got a deferment. After 1 year, he wrote me, and he said, Dad, I think this is my calling, to be with the poor. Obviously, that accentuated our thinking, and so we started doing things in Uganda. We built a hospital, the first hospital built since the British had left Uganda in the 60s, and then they conceived an idea for schools, et cetera, and I'll come back to that. So suffice it to say, by the late 1980s, we were very heavily involved in hands-on projects with the poor, and really self-help projects that would lead them into personal dignity, having the ability to embrace what life would have for them. I've traveled the world, as you said, and I've noticed that people have the same questions. Who am I? Why am I here? What am I supposed to be doing, and where am I going? And that's true whether you're sitting on a hut and a thatched roof on a mud floor, or whether you're sitting in a boardroom. And so we combine the spiritual with the practical, but we never help people on the condition that they will accept what we believe. We just go in the name of Jesus, in the love of him, and if he calls them, he calls them. But we're not out proselytizing the poor with giving them things. And that's the process we followed all of our life. In 1990, Chuck Colson, who you might remember from the Watergate years, went to prison, came out, and started a group called Prison Fellowship. And I had met him in 1984. We had prayed together, and we had maintained a friendship through those years. And my wife and I had a condo in Sanibel Island. He drove up there from Naples, Florida, and we had lunch. And he said, Mike, what's God's call on your life? And I said, the poor. And he said, who do you think are the poorest of the poor? And I said, you know, I've seen so many poor people, Chuck. I don't know who the poorest of the poor is. And he said, well, I believe the poorest of the poor are the imprisoned, because in addition to being poor, they've lost their dignity. They've lost, in many cases, their name. They've lost everything, including their freedom. And he said, come and work with me in prisons. And I said, Chuck, I don't know if I have that call, but I'll think and pray about it. And then he said something that was really galvanizing to me. He said, in the Christian church, he said, we are hopelessly divided. And that is why there's very little attraction to it. He said, what if I as a Baptist and you as a Catholic stood together and forgot about our historic divisions and differences and just stood in the love of Jesus to help the poorest of the poor? What kind of message would that send? Well, that really intrigued me, because I believe unless people come together, there is no hope. And so after a period of time, I agreed, and I joined the board of Prison Fellowship U.S., which is really one of 112 countries that call themselves Prison Fellowship, and it's really the flagship, the largest organization in the world meeting prisoners. Today in the United States, there are approximately 2,200,000 prisoners at a cost that is absolutely horrific to our society. When you consider, like in Michigan, we have 52,000 incarcerated, and at a cost of somewhere between $25,000 and $30,000 per year, which money, if it was spent for health or education, would be a tremendous boon to our society. But our prison population is growing exponentially. And just to give you a comparison, in the entire nation of Japan, which is half the population of the United States, there's only 82,000 in prison. In Michigan, which has a population of just below 10 million, we have 52,000. It's a worldwide problem, fueled by drugs in the main. There are well over 10 million people in the prisons of the world. The United States incarcerates more per capita than any other nation. It is a huge problem, but what is the sleeping problem that people don't realize is the rate of recidivism. We have a rate, and it depends on how you measure it, but we have a rate of recidivism in this country that is between 60% and 70%, which means that a person being released from prison today, approximately two-thirds will be back in prison within 3 years. And so you can see how these numbers are growing at incredible rates. And our politicians have been slow to realize this. Society has been slow to realize this.
You and Nancy, on your own nickel, have visited 111 countries. You've been in front of death row inmates all over the world. What have you learned from them, Mike?
Well, I have learned humility, for one thing. You know, Jack, we don't take Jesus into the prisons. We go to meet him while he's there. I have met men on death row who are about to die, who had an epiphany of faith, truly remorseful. It's interesting. I was on death row down in Huntsville, Texas. Every single person that was there for murder had committed murder under the influences of alcohol and drugs, usually both. And so many of them were, in some ways, you know, I guess everyone's afraid to die to some degree, but many of them knew that they were guilty, and they had prepared themselves. Many had given their life to Christ and asked forgiveness, much like the thief on the cross.
You've visited with presidents, kings, dictators, all over the world. What have you learned from these people?
Well, I've learned one thing: they don't have any answers. I have met with many of the world leaders. I've been in difficult places like Iraq, Syria. I went with a friend and saw Milosevic during the Balkan War. And in each case, we ask them a very simple question. You have tremendous alienation in your country. What is the answer for alienation?
When we come back, we'll ask Mike, what is the answer? I'm Jack Crisula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Mike Timmis. To recap, 2.2 million people in America in prisons. Two-thirds of them that get out will be back within 3 years. The cost is unbelievable. Mike, what's the answer?
Well, the only answer, Jack, is a change of heart. Unfortunately, in this country, we have very few true rehabilitation projects. One of the things Prison Fellowship does is it has created many programs of restorative justice. And restorative justice is just what it says. It is in, you know, there are many people, and I hope your listeners don't get this wrong, who deserve never to see the light of day for things they have done. But that's not the majority of people in prison. The majority of people in prison have made very bad choices, and they're paying for it. But the answer is a change of heart. And in many systems around the world that I have visited, particularly in the Orient, you know, a prisoner either works or a prisoner goes to school. I have a young friend. He's in his early 40s. I visited him for a few years in prison. He went into prison in his late 20s. He was a drug dealer or carrier and bringing marijuana up from Texas. With no prior offenses and a nonviolent crime, he got 20 years and no parole, which absolutely makes no sense. Through our restorative justice program, we were able to get that law changed because it took, when it was a mandatory sentencing law, it took any discretion away from a judge and put people in jail for 20 years with no prospects of parole. I mean, it was against the law to parole them, whereas a murderer could have applied for parole within that period, and there would have been the ability, if that person was truly rehabilitated, to let them out. So this is an example of a law that keeps people in prison that makes no sense. Well, that law, thank God, has now been changed. But this man, I tried to get a sentence commuted and with no success, and I had told the governor that I would hire him personally. And I kept that promise, even though he was ultimately paroled. And he worked for me for 2 years. Now, he had served 11 years, and he had done nothing in prison. He had just sat there for 11 years. Now, in his case, he was a self-starter. He took correspondence courses, et cetera, et cetera. But he got out after 11 years. I hired him. He worked for me for 2 years. He still works a little bit part-time, but now he started his own business. And it's so tremendous to see a man like this who has had a change of heart. His change of heart was he asked Christ into his life, and he started to live in accordance with what every good citizen should live, and with love and joy and peace and taking care of his neighbor, loving God, and then loving his neighbor as himself. And that is the only change that I have seen that really keeps people out of prison.
A couple years ago, you let me go with you to Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Romania. Changed my life. Outside Prague one day, one beautiful day, we met a 45-year-old nun named Sister Consolata that had been running a woman's prison for 7 years, 70 women prisoners, two in for murder. Can you tell about Sister?
Well, she was an amazing person because she was a visionary. And she had convinced the authorities in Czechoslovakia to, or I should say the Czech Republic, to allow her to do this experiment. And as you said, this was a woman's prison combined with an old person's home, a nursing home. And what she did is she rehabilitated these young women who had committed crimes by having them serve the older people. And in most cases, women are in prison because of a man. They've been abused, not in all, but in most cases, they've been abused. They've taken drugs, they've carried drugs, they've sold drugs, sold themselves, etc. and their personal dignity has really diminished. And this nun was able, through this program, by having these young women serve older people, men and women, there was a mutual bond of love formed between these women and these old people. And it was just incredible to see how these women were being rehabilitated, attaining personal dignity, the way they took care of themselves, the way they took care of their rooms in this facility, but the incredible love of the old people for them, the empathy. And in some cases, I'm sure that for many of these women, these were the only parents that they ever had. But it shows that with innovative programs, there is a possibility of restorative justice.
There were no locks on the doors. There were no bars in the windows. Then we go to Romania. We spend 3 days with a male version of Sister Teresa, Constantine. Can you talk about him?
Well, the amazing man. He had been a head of the communist youth movement of Romania, ultimately ran afoul of somebody, went into prison. And while he was in prison, he had a profound spiritual experience and met Christ. He's an Orthodox, in the Orthodox tradition. He came out, and today, in the 32 Romanian prisons, the majority of prisoners being gypsies and somewhat despised in that country, he has reached out to them and built homes for women with children. He has rehabilitation projects. For example, last year he established a pig farm so that people getting out of prison would have a job and they could raise pigs, sell pork, etc. And he's done many of these things. One of the most difficult things for people getting out of prison is, and one of the reasons they go back to crime, is there's no alternatives.
For most people, Christ is the spare tire of their life. Something goes wrong, we get in the trunk, we get it out. Get me through this one, and I promise. For you, he's the steering wheel of your life. What do you say to a couple that says, we're so busy earning a living, raising a family, we don't have the time to help others?
Well, in most of those cases, really they're saying to me, I don't want to make the time, because people make time for things they want to do. I don't care how hard they're working. Even I made time for things I wanted to do when I was working hard. I played tennis 3 or 4 times a week, etc. The simple fact is that you either live for yourself or you live for something else. And I lived for myself for many years, and I found that it didn't bring me any satisfaction. And materialism ultimately is not going to bring you any satisfaction. I don't know anybody who has cancer that is interested in their next car or their next vacation. And I think that sooner or later, when the storms of life hit us, all of us have to face that fact.
Mike, thanks for coming on. Thanks for being a role model to so many of us, not just in this town, but all over the world. And thanks for sharing your story. Our guest next Sunday will be Skitch Henderson, a one-man celebration of 20th century American music. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because anything is possible. Spahoma.